Hi, readers. Welcome to Books Connect Us from Penguin Random House. This is a podcast about staying connected with each other and the stories and authors who inspire us. The Most Reverend Michael B. Curry is the presiding bishop of the Episcopal Church and the first African-American to lead the denomination. A noted advocate for human rights and author of several books, Bishop Curry is recognized as one of the most popular preachers in the English language. In his latest book, Love is the Way, Bishop Curry leads readers to discover the gifts they need in order to live the way of love. Deep reservoirs of hope and resilience, simple wisdom, the discipline of nonviolence, and unshakable regard for human dignity. Now let's join Penguin senior editor Nina Shield in conversation with Bishop Michael Curry.
Hi, Bishop Curry.
Hello,
it's
Nina.
Such a delight to see your face. I have to say that my 15-month-old absolutely loves the cover of your book. Your smile is so warm and welcoming. So thank you for that. She always waves at it when she sees it on the shelf. Yeah.
Oh, tell her hello for me.
Yes, I will.
I love that.
So how are you in these very strange times?
Well, like everybody else, living a very strange life. But
yeah. Yeah, no, obviously a lot has changed for all of us these past few months, but I just remember with your first book with us, your schedule was so packed, you know, we sort of had to jigsaw everything together around your free moments, dashing between flights. So how has that kind of reduced schedule changed your approach to life, ministry, work?
Well, a lot of it, I mean, the travel's reduced. And so what has now, instead of getting on a plane, I get on Zoom. And spend my days a lot of times really literally in front of a camera or the computer or I mean, that's literally how I'm living. Learning how to pace through that has been a trick. Just kind of learning how to, so I've continued to do so much of what I do is about my mouth, running my mouth. So all I need is a camera and a microphone and I can pretty much do that. It's just a little strange preaching to a camera sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. I know journalist Anne Helen Peterson's been writing a lot about burnout and specifically about burnout among pastors, rabbis, and just spiritual leaders in general. Is that something you've been seeing? There's so much pain and uncertainty, and that's so much for you to carry.
Yeah, and for, you know, for pastors and rabbis and imams, I mean, anybody who has pastoral care of folk, you're doing a lot of it remotely or by Zoom, Zoom or whatever the equivalents are. And there's something about not actually being in the physical proximity of a person that is more draining than being in their presence, even if it's a tense or a painful kind of situation. I mean, I've prayed with people who are dying like this, instead of being able to touch them. Sometimes a touch says more than your words can, you know what I mean? And that's, and you don't have that by this, but this is better than nothing. I'm not complaining about it. It is better than nothing. And I do think that clergy for the most part are caregivers. They're the second wave. and they're doing a lot of that without the ability to be present fully with people. There is something about, I mean, you know, we are our worst headache, but we're also our best medicine. And we kind of need each other and need to be near each other and smell each other and feel each other. There's just something about that experience of being in the full presence of another person that makes it possible, even in hard times, to carry each other's burdens. That's harder to do on the telephone or on a computer screen.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I've been to now 2 Zoom memorials and also my daughter turned 1 year old and, you know, just to not be able to have, though, like a real big party, all of this really made me realize the importance of sort of cultural ritual and community and coming together and just as a way to process those feelings and how we're all sort of stagnant now not being able to do that.
Yeah. I mean, the rituals carry us. They actually do. They perform a function in those liminal moments between the capacity of words to do it and the reality of something that's either joyful or sorrowful. And sometimes the liturgy of ritual has the capacity to carry us when we can't do it ourselves. And when we're limited by not being able to be physically close, it makes it even more difficult. Not impossible, but but more difficult.
Yeah, no, like you said, definitely better than nothing, but still sort of a pale shadow, I think, of what we hopefully we'll get back to in the not super distant future. I guess we can move on now, talk a little bit about your wonderful book, Love is the Way. Your previous book, The Power of Love, was a collection of some of your favorite sermons, but this is obviously different, a memoir. So what was it like writing about, you know, childhood, your own spiritual journey? How was that process for you? Was there anything sort of tough or unexpected reactions you had while you were writing?
You know, I have to admit, there was a part of me that, I mean, I don't think of myself as a humble person, but I have to admit, there's a part of me that went through a stage of real embarrassment. It's like, why am I talking about myself? I mean, this feels, this really feels vain, or, you know, or something. There was an awkwardness. And then after a while, just telling the story, it's a story and telling the story. I was surprised at how, at least for me, even though I knew this, how much the power of human community is a mediator of love. And again, it can be a headache too, but is and can be a mediator of love. And I think we're seeing some of that in the time of pandemic when we're cut off from community. It's a lifeline. It actually is a lifeline into something bigger than ourselves. Anyway, I've realized that that's been a part of a theme of my own journey, that in some of the most difficult times, it's been the power of experiencing what Teilhard de Chardin called the energies of love, kind of actually experiencing that to help to carry you through. That's been a consistent thing, whether it was the time of the death of my mother or decisions of conscience on down the road that weren't going to be popular, and how you kind of navigate that. Having a community of wisdom, a community of accountability, a community of support, a community that lifts you beyond just yourself, that's really important. It matters. And that was a discovery for me. It has mattered in my life.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, as you say, community is critical. It's a really interesting time for community action. In some ways, we're so much more isolated than usual, but the crisis has also invigorated some of our kind of smaller, more local worlds. Someone comes to you now, you know, wanting to get involved, wanting to make the world a little bit better, how do you advise them when we're so limited in some ways?
Well, the good thing is we do have the capacity to be in touch. And the first step is to be in touch with folk who are actually involved on the ground, especially in local communities, and trusted and reliable entities that are involved in social change and social justice work that have some track record. I mean, you have to be careful online because you really don't know who's behind that screen, so to speak. But there really are trusted groups, you know, religious organizations, social organizations that have been around, political organizations that have been around, as well as local community groups. I mean, there are a lot, most things get done locally, to be very honest. And that's where you can find people who have common concerns and convictions. Now, again, I'm sort of an older world. And so sort of all the Black Lives Matter movement and the protests and those kinds of things have happened in different networks, in different ways. I mean, my daughter has gone to marches and I didn't even know about them. And she found out about them online or through social media. So there are all sorts of connection ways where the marches are announced that way. It's not the old way we used to do it. And the word gets out. But there are ways, if you want to be connected and involved, that you can be. They're just limitations of physicality, that's all. But that's not impossible. So if you're going to be involved in advocating and lobbying with whether it's congressional representatives around the local level, that stuff's being done by Zoom. They are still accessible by email, by phone call, on social media. You know, politicians actually pay attention to what voters are thinking. They actually do, because they get elected or not elected by voters. Mm-hmm. So they pay attention. And so you can still communicate effectively and be involved significantly. Just not as physical as it once was.
Yeah. I think on the sort of question of politics, you know, so many people, families, communities are split down the middle politically right now. And the idea of holding on to love and hope in the face of the rage, resentment, despair that, you know, we're all feeling on either side of the divide to a certain extent. How do we move forward from that space? How does that work in actual practical terms?
You know, I mean, I really do believe that on a basic level, a commitment to be a certain kind of person is a decision. Now, the follow through takes more than that. I know that. But ultimately, you got to say, you know what? I want to be like this. That's not how I want to be. I think there was a moment for many at Charlottesville, and there may be a moment for many at the murder of George Floyd, when I think most people, because I do think most people are people of goodwill and decency. But most people, I think, look and saw what happened in Charlottesville and the shrieks of hatred and bigotry by young people dressed in khakis with tiki torches in hands. I mean, to see that and then to see a man's life snuffed out by one life snuffed out by another human being, to actually watch him call for his mother to say, "I can't breathe." Most of us, I think, looked and said, that is not who we want to be. That was a moment. Those were moments of almost decision. That's not us. That's not America. That's not who we want to be. The decision to be a person who is defined by an unselfish, sacrificial way of living, which is what love is. That's how I want to live. That's how I want to dominate my life. That's how the direction I want my life to go into. That's a decision that then gets reinforced by actions and commitments and things and how you do it. But without that decision, you just get buffeted by what comes along and what you experience. But that constant, it's almost like, you know, in the old revivalist tradition, there was always an altar call. And at the altar call, people used to come down and, you know, make their religious commitment and all that kind of stuff. It's almost like a daily altar call, you know, a commitment to this. I'm going to do the best I can to be a person of unselfish living that seeks to bless as well as be blessed, to actually seek the good. And, you know, I really believe in it, and I don't think this is crazy. I mean, imagine if we were all making that kind of daily decision and trying to work and live the day out of that. We're not going to be perfect at it. I know that. But we'll be a heck of a lot better. A heck of a lot better. And I've said this to office holders. This, if you can just find somebody who's across the aisle, why don't you take a stab at friendship? I didn't say agreement. You don't have to agree politically. I mean, good God, I've been married to my wife almost 40 years. Trust me, agreement is not, you agree on the relationship. After that, good Lord, who knows what you'll agree on and disagree on? That's just the nature of being human. But yet find somebody across the aisle, somebody who has a different worldview than you do, and get to know them as a person. What's the story behind the views you actually hold? There's usually a story there. There are some life experiences there. Sometimes it's, you know, and even in moments of unbridled selfishness, trust me, there's a story behind that selfishness. There's something going on there. But sometimes if you get to know a person, as a human being, below the skin level, below the facade levels, below all the stuff, you may discover a brother, a sister, a sibling, a fellow child of God, a fellow human being. And when that happens, how you engage and debate and discuss, it may be vigorous, you may disagree, but you don't disagree about that person, about the humanity of that other person. And that, I'm sorry, that is a profound shift in human relationships that will shift our political arrangements, will shift our national debates. And I believe in this country at this time, but it's not just limited to the US, in this country at this time, this revival of relationships between us, it may be the necessary link to hold together e pluribus unum so we have a democracy that actually can work. because democracy will not work if we don't acknowledge each other as brothers, sisters, and siblings. It won't work.
Yeah.
This is one time where our fundamental religious, spiritual, moral convictions actually are what undergird E Pluribus Unum.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess, you know, the question when you, I mean, we think about the coming election and everything.
Oh, yeah.
What if, you know, your neighbor isn't willing to extend that humanity, you know, or, you know, how does that work on a sort of practical level? Is the answer you just sort of do the best you can and try to extend that love into the world? Is there anything that what can we do?
You kind of do the best you can. You do. You love them anyway. And loving them anyway doesn't mean you agree with them or that you let somebody walk all over you. That's not what we're talking about. But that, you know, I don't know why you're acting the way you are toward me. I don't know. But I'm not going to act toward you the way you're acting toward me. I mean, that there's almost a natural, I don't know if it's instinct or whatever it is, to I mean, if you hit me, my natural inclination is it's either fight or flight. I'm either going to hit you back or I'm going to run. I mean, that's, you know, and I suppose there's some biological and evolutionary reason for that. That makes sense. But in terms of a social compact and a society, I've got to move beyond fight or flight and find a middle way. I think this way of unselfish love is that middle way. And it doesn't mean that you don't do anything. I mean, I think one of the most powerful witnesses to love in our time was John Lewis.
Of course.
I mean, he fought for what was right. But part of what was right was not just policy changes, changes in law. Part of what was right was the struggle to love even those who opposed him and would continue his oppression. That's spiritual work. It's kind of like, remember that old Broadway play, your arms are too short to box with God. I mean, Michael Curry doesn't have the strength to pull that one off all by himself. That's where we need what Dr. King called cosmic companionship. Mm-hmm. We need spiritual companionship. We need spiritual energy from the source as well as our own energy and capacity. And that partnership yields the possibility of us moving in that third way rather than our instinctual fight or flight.
Somewhat related, one part of the book that I think readers will really find fascinating is your explanation of the division within the church when it came to the issue of LGBTQ rights. For someone like me, who had no knowledge of, you know, that those kinds of conversations were going on behind the scenes, it was a little inside baseball in a good way. So what was it like for you to write about the history there? And it's sort of a lot of what you're kind of saying now, where, you know, you have to have these conversations with people who, in, you know, you respect and in a lot of ways are like-minded, but you have this really fundamental difference with them.
You know, it really, it's hard work. It is hard work. It's soul work, S-O-U-L. It's soul work. It really is. And I have to admit it was one of the first times that I experienced directly antipathy directed at me. Now, it was by virtue of office and all of that kind of stuff. But that kind of antipathy directed at me that I couldn't in any way, shape, manner, I couldn't undo. Mm. I mean, I couldn't undo. And there was even one moment, I remember we were having kind of town hall gatherings throughout the church when I was serving here in North Carolina. And things were so hot after one of the kind of gatherings, and there were town hall conversations, and I would talk with folk and answer. There were a couple hundred people there. People kind of standing around. I was talking to individuals and that kind of thing. And one man was so angry that he lunged at me. I mean, he literally lunged. I saw him out of the corner of my eye, but I didn't know. And my wife happened to be at this particular one who's an old school teacher. Don't tell her I called her old, but I mean, school teacher. I think she just instinctively did the school teacher thing when there was a fight on the playground. She jumped in the way and he stopped. Wow. I mean, I kind of saw all that happen out of the corner of my, there was that level of anger of, wow. If people were really angry and upset and hurt, partially because they didn't understand. There was a lot of that going on. This was, I mean, the reality was, I mean, the, our taboos have been in place and they've been religiously sanctified, if you will, and sanctioned probably since the dawn of consciousness, I guess. This was sex and race is about as deep as you're going to get. Yeah. I mean, that's getting down to the nitty gritty, or where an old preacher friend of mine used to say, where the nitty meets the gritty. I mean, that's way down there. And so they're visceral reactions. And that happened in, you know, the Episcopal Church, Anglican Communion, the Methodist, I mean, all of the religious traditions, because religious traditions go back to some of those deep roots, where sex and race are being managed by religion. You see, there's some real, again, it's beyond my pay grade, but there's deep stuff there.
Yep.
And so when it got to the larger level of, I mean, kind of the worldwide Anglican Communion, all of a sudden you inject different cultures into this. I mean, the Anglican Communion is like 85 million folk. It's wherever the British Empire was at one time. That's what the Anglican Communion, I probably shouldn't say it that way, but that really is true. That's what it was. It was the British Empire at prayer, so to speak. And so imagine all of those countries that are now independent. These are different cultures, different worlds. And I remember saying to folk here in North Carolina, it's important to remember that San Francisco, California, and Kampala, Uganda, are on the same planet, but they are in different worlds. They really are. I mean, that's, we live in different cultural worlds, and all, so that when you have the question of LGBTQ rights and in the church and in civil society, we're talking about cultures in different places. So you've got religion, you've got race, you've got sex, you've got identity, gender identity, you've got cultural stuff. You got, put all that mixed together and you've got an explosive mix. Yeah. And there is no way, I believe, to navigate that apart from starting at a place that every one of us is a child of God. That God has not made me or you more a child of God than anybody else. And I remember when I was talking with the archbishops and the heads of the various churches, and I said, the same love that I believe makes room and space in the church for LGBTQ folk makes you room and space for you who disagree with me, and room for me as I disagree with you. And that's a love that's bigger than any of us. Mm. And if we'll just trust that, we may figure out in time how to move forward together. I don't know any other way to really do that. Now, you have to legislate in countries and that kind of thing, but ultimately, legislation can only go so far. Ultimately, legislation must protect us from bad behavior and protect our rights. But ultimately, there has to be a conversion of the heart. Something in the person has to change. You must move from law to heart, from law to love. Mm-hmm. And that has to happen ultimately to change the culture, change the society, and change the world. And it can.
Are you hopeful?
Yes, not in the sense that I know exactly what the outcomes are, or not even in the sense that I necessarily will see what they are. But I'm hopeful that humanity will find a way to be better. We have done that. Now, when I say be better, I don't mean the fullness of heaven coming down on earth. I mean, I'm not a utopian. But I do, I know for, I mean, I can't remember, this probably wasn't in the book, but my, I remember when I was a kid, I'm not sure what grade it was, but I came home and my father said, did you get your medicine today? And I was wondering how he knew that. And they had given us these little, it was a sugar cube, and it had this little, I think it was red or pink stuff in it. Well, it was polio vaccine. And yeah, I said, yeah, they gave us, you know, we had the sugar, it tasted pretty good. I didn't taste the medicine on it. And he said, you know what it's for? I said, well, it was polio. I didn't really know. I don't know how old I was. But we had this conversation. I didn't really realize until it was years later that I realized the significance of that to him. I knew my father always walked with a limp, but I never knew why. And when he had his stroke, and I was sitting in, or standing in the ICU with my his sister, my Aunt Carrie, the one who called me that time in the midst of the debate about sexuality and said, I'm proud of you. It was that same Aunt Carrie. She started rubbing his legs. And I said, what is she doing? And she started singing to him, singing, you know, religious songs. And I was like, what is, and you know, well, she was off key. But anyway, she was singing songs. And I was asking, I said, well, why are you rubbing his leg? And she said, that's what mama used to do when he was a little boy. And I said, why'd he do that? And she said, didn't you know? I said, didn't I know what? She said, your daddy had polio when he was a little boy.
Wow.
And that was what they told him to do, to rub the legs and then to put some kind of salve or something on him. And then they would wrap him up. We actually found a picture of him as looked like about 5 years old with the tape wrapped on him. And that's why he, and then I went back to that memory and realized that kind of, Nina, that's the power of a love that is so deep. A love that can change the world. I don't know anything about Johannes Salk. I don't know anything about Albert Sadin except that. All I know is we found a way to wipe out polio. Now it still exists. And it does exist in parts of the world, but we found a way to manage it and control it. That's human improvement. I don't believe improvement or progress happens, as Dr. King said, on wheels of inevitability. No. It comes from hard work, and it comes from pressure, and it comes from keeping on, but it keeps from people. It happens because there are some people who really do believe we can be better, and we will be, and we're going to work until we are. And even if I don't see it now, your daughter will. We must do now what will be a benefit for your daughter and other children like her. That's what this is about. That's love, a commitment to something greater than self. That's gonna bless the self too. I mean, you will get blessed out of it too. But that's a life worth living. I mean, and you know, if there was a passionate commitment by all of us to just do that, I'm telling you, it's a different ball game. It is. I've seen the world change for the good. Not automatically, not inevitably, not without struggle, not without pain. Frederick Douglass was right. There is no progress without struggle. But doggone it, it's better than regress. And the old preachers used to, I don't know if this is probably in the book either. I think this is. The old preachers used to have a sermon. There were sermons that old black preachers that just kind of circulated as oral. They kind of were the oral tradition, if you will. And one that I haven't heard anybody preach in years, but it was entitled, What Did You Do With Your Dash? And the old preacher would say, you know, when you go to the cemetery and you look on the headstones and you see so-and-so buried here, and then you see the date of their birth and the date of their death, and say, you know, that person really couldn't control how they were born or when they were born. And for the most part, they didn't have much control over when they died. The question is, what did they do with the little dash in between? What did you do with your dash? Is this world just even incrementally better because I passed along this way? Or did I just show up and consume oxygen? I think we can produce carbon dioxide, whatever the good is in photosynthesis, you know, in respiration. I think and believe that we can, but it starts with a decision, and then finding ways to live into that decision and to nourish it and nurture it.
Wow, thank you. I needed that. I think we all need your words of wisdom and guidance and some path forward these days, because these are very strange, dark times. Yeah. Is there anything that you have been reading for inspiration? Anything that you recommend either related to these themes or not at all? Do you have time to read?
Actually, that's one thing that being housebound, so to speak, has imposed. There's time in between when I'm actually reading physical books. I usually read on a plane, on a tablet. You know, I've got the Kindle on the tablet, but actual physical book, I'm reading two books right now. That one is, it's the autobiography of Jane Goodall. Mm. I mean, I've known about her, and I've known about her, but not about her. What a human being! Oh dear God!
I
won't get into the whole story, but it's she wrote it some years ago, a number of years ago. And then I'm reading a book that somebody sent me about 3 years ago, and it was a book, and I had it here at the house, and I just never got around to reading it because I don't take physical books as much with me on planes and stuff. If it's not on a tablet, I'm probably not gonna read it. Anyway, so I picked this book. It was Eleanor Roosevelt, A Spiritual Journey. And I said, well, okay, I've always been curious about Eleanor. So I'm reading this book about Eleanor Roosevelt. And it's really about her spirituality that was behind her passionate commitment for human rights and human decency. It grew out of a very deep faith, and which I kind of knew, but I mean, I really hadn't. I mean, I read Eleanor Franklin. I mean, I read, so you know it's there, but I didn't realize how profoundly it was there. And those two books, I've just finished them. I've got one I really want to read, The Gentleman in Moscow.
It's so good.
I got it downstairs, and that's my next one. Yeah. So I've gotten back into actually reading physical books, not just, I know Kindle books are the same.
It's different, yeah.
Old school. I do still like to hold the book kind of turn the page in case that's something I want to go back to and look at.
I agree. Great recommendations and really inspirational women you're reading.
Oh, but that's true.
Very cool.
They're remarkable people who have walked on this planet.
Absolutely.
And they still do.
Yeah, thank you so much. This has been such a wonderful conversation. Again, I really felt like I needed it on this sort of gray day that I'm having here. So really appreciate it.
Hang in there, friend. We'll hang in there together.
Yes, thank you.
Oh, God bless you.
And now, here's an exclusive excerpt from the audiobook, courtesy of Penguin Random House Audio.
In my own life, love has had so many, many faces, but among the boldest is the face of Josie Robbins. Josie, who is 85 years old as I write this, and still in my life, was one of the people who took care of me and my sister when my mother passed away after a long illness. When my father first asked her to help take care of us during Mommy's illness and after, she wasn't a longtime family friend. She was just a lady who stopped by his church some Sundays to drop off her neighbor's child before going to her own Baptist church. But she heard about our family situation and asked, "How can I help?" Soon thereafter, my father nervously welcomed her into our house and led her to the spare bedroom, where both twin beds were covered with clothes that my father had managed to wash but not iron. Josie had never been to our house, hadn't met the children who wore most of those clothes, but she ironed every single garment with love. A little later, my father called. He was running late. Could she give his kids lunch? We, who had been instructed to play upstairs and not bother Ms. Robbins, came running down to meet the woman who would eventually be a surrogate mother to us. I can't remember the day, but she says that after lunch, I pulled up a chair next to her ironing board and didn't stop talking until the moment she finished and left. Moved by love, Josie jumped in with both arms and never let go. She would take me and my sister on the bus to the W.T. Grant store in downtown Buffalo so that we could head straight for the parakeets and hamsters like we had done with Mommy. She made the hurt go away. She was the only person my tender-headed sister
ever let wash and braid her hair, because no one else in this world was so patient and careful not to pull. She had dinner with us so many nights, and over the years was present at all our family events and big days, from my high school, college, and seminary graduations to weddings, ordinations, births, and baptisms, and on and on and on. Josie Robbins is what love looks like. It's important that we define the word love here with clarity, because these days we use the word to mean so many things. We might use it to talk about how we feel about our spouse or a significant other, or about our children, or about our new sofa. The love I'm talking about isn't love on a Valentine's Day card. Those are nice, but they're not what I have in mind when I say that love is the only thing that can save the planet. Many languages have several words for love to encompass all the different kinds and dimensions. The three most frequently used in Koine Greek, the language of the New Testament, are eros, philia, and agape. Eros is romantic or sexual love. Our English word erotic comes from that. Eros is what Valentine's Day is about. Philia is fraternal or brotherly love, which is why the city of Philadelphia is called the city of brotherly love. Finally, there is agape, which is love for the other, sacrificial love that seeks the good and well-being of others, of society, of the world. Unfortunately, in English, we have only the one word, love, for everything from telenovelas to Mother Teresa. And so the different dimensions and nuances have all been muddled together, which has obscured love's true power to instigate a better world. Agape, love that looks outward, is the love that I'm most interested in. You may not have heard the Greek word before, but you've experienced agape. Think about someone who impacted your life for the good, someone who stood by you, pushed you, believed in you, even sacrificed for you. Odds are they weren't doing it because it served them. They were doing it because they cared about you, because they wanted life's sweetness to open wide to you. Love is a firm commitment to act for the well-being of someone other than yourself. It can be personal or political, individual or communal, intimate or public. Love will not be segregated to the private, personal precincts of life. Love, as I read it in the Bible, is ubiquitous. It affects all aspects of life. What I didn't know as a kid was that Josie Robbins' love, shared so generously with my family, had changed many other lives as well. Josie was a principal at St. Augustine's School, a high school for pregnant and parenting teens. She had walked in thinking that it was a summer position and never left. In the 1960s, when girls got pregnant in Buffalo, like most other places, they weren't allowed to stay in school. But Josie and St. Augustine's, which became Fulton Academic Complex, with the support of the public school system, picked them back up. They gave them the chance at a better future for themselves and their children. Because of Josie, thousands of girls got their diplomas and the pride of walking the stage to graduate with their class. The school is now closed, partly because Josie retired, but also because Josie and others advocated until the day the public schools stopped punishing those mothers who were still children themselves, so they could get their education and keep their dignity. An oft-quoted passage in the New Testament says, "God so loved the world that he gave his only son." The Greek word used by the New Testament writer for the word love is agape, and the Greek word used for world is cosmos. But what it really means is everything. Everything that is. Cosmos is what the spiritual is talking about when it says of God, he's got the whole world in his hands. God so loved the world that he gave. God gave. God did not take. God gave. That's agape. That's love. And love such as that is the way to the heart of God, the heart of each other. It is the way to a new world that looks something more like God's dream for us and all creation, what Dante spoke of as the love that moves the sun and stars.
Thank you for listening to Books Connect Us. For more great book recommendations and information about your favorite authors, feel free to follow Penguin Random House on social media or visit penguinrandomhouse.com. And if you've enjoyed what you've heard, go ahead and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, as it helps more listeners to find our show. This podcast is produced by Pat Stango and edited by Clayton Gumbert. I've been Erin Leaf, and until next time, this has been Books Connect Us.